Second Place with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.
Hi, I'm Adam.
And I'm Sabine. Welcome to the 17th episode of Robots. Today we'll be talking to Raoul Ordonnier, who is the head of the Motorman Robotics Laboratory at the University of Dayton. You've probably heard about him because he's been featured in our news section lately for his dancing industrial robots. But before we dive into that, let's hear the latest news with Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. The first weeks of this new year were marked by a series of robotic novelties showcased at the annual Consumer Electronics Show, CES, in Las Vegas. Robot toy company Wowie showed off three new robots, including Jobot, which can beatbox and dance, the Roborover, which is a tracked version of the Tribot, and Spyball, a spherical telepresence robot that can take photos and videos. It also announced extension of its Flytech series with two more flying robots. iBot introduced a second version of its gutter-cleaning robot, Luge 2, a new version of the Roomba, and also launched its YouTube channel, iTube. The world's largest producer of lawnmowers, Husqvarna, demoed a lawn-mowing robot, which uses solar panels to extend cutting time. And AnyBots launched a new telepresence robot, riding on a Segway-like base and equipped with a video screen and a laser pointer to point at charts or any other relevant things. Researchers at the Shimoyama Matsumoto Laboratory at the University of Tokyo have created a tiny flapping wing robot weighing a mere 0.28 grams or roughly a hundredth of an ounce. The Ornithopter uses rubber bands to flap a pair of butterfly wings at a frequency of about 10 Hz. The researchers constructed and tested three types of artificial butterfly wings using thin polymer membranes and micro-molded polyurethane veins to investigate the morphological function of actual butterfly wings. Finally, researchers at the Tokyo University of Agriculture and Technology have unveiled a full-body robot suit for farmers. In a demonstration, the 25-kilogram device was shown supporting a person's muscles and joints while pulling radishes from the ground in a crouched position and picking oranges from high branches. The researchers said they were looking to commercial use of the suit in 2 to 3 years at an initial relatively low price ranging from 4,000 to 8,000 euros or roughly 5,000 to 10,000 US dollars. A summary of new robots at this year's CES, a high-speed video of the flight of the 0.23-gram Ornithopter, and more information on the new exoskeleton are available on our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Raoul Ordonnier is the director of the new Motoman Robotics Lab at the University of Dayton in Ohio. In collaboration with the Motoman company, he'll be looking to advance the technology behind industrial robots, such as those used to automate factories. For example, systems capable of deciding their actions based on visual feedback instead of the traditional open-loop control could allow industrial robots to complete complex tasks, such as juggling.
But when the robots are not used for research and everyone has their back turned, the Motoman robots come to life to the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies or the Star Wars theme music.
Finally, he tells us about his long-standing research subject, nonlinear control, and the work done at the nonlinear control lab he directs.
Hi, Raoul. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hello, Sabine.
You're the director of the new Motoman Robotics Lab at the University of Dayton. Can you present this lab to us?
Oh, sure. Well, this lab is a lab we are very happy and excited about. It was established at the University of Dayton in August of 2008. It came about because of interest by Motoman, which is a company that is actually headquartered in Dayton, in Ohio. And it distributes robots made in Japan by a company called Yaskawa. So Yaskawa makes, you know, some very high-profile, high-quality industrial robots. And Motoman distributes them here in the U.S., and they also, you know, they make system solutions, and they work with companies that actually use the robots, so they provide more of the system side of the robots and service. And Motoman was interested in establishing a, you know, a high-profile, a very nice lab at the university, and they approached us. And, you know, the discussions took place early in 2008, and it was decided that they would donate to us six of their very nice robots. So, you know, we made a choice as to what robots would work best for us, and the whole thing then was completed, and the robots were delivered to us to the university and during the summer, and we had to overhaul a whole room for you know, to place the lab. Once it was done, we were able to put the robots in there, and now they're there. So we are trying to now get the robot up and running and make very good use of it.
What type of applications are these Motoman robots usually used for?
Well, you know, as I said, they're industrial, so many times they're used for welding or painting or manipulating and sorting. So they are really meant to be used in that way, in their normal usage.
So now you have this great lab equipped with these high-profile robots. What is your vision for the future? What are your motivations?
Well, you know, the fact that they are so so good, such high-quality robots, really allows us to be creative and to just let our imagination run free. Because, you know, I mean, one could, of course, just say, okay, this lab has industrial robots, therefore we will use them for, you know, manufacturing type of activities. But, you know, that would really, I guess, not exploit the fact that they are so capable. So what we're thinking is instead to focus right now on visual servoing, in other words, to use cameras connected to computers, and have the computers, you know, use image processing so that they can figure out what, you know, what's going on, and then have this information being fed to control systems that then tell the robots what to do. In other words, have the robots then be able to visually interact with their environment and essentially implement a control system whose sensing is visual.
That's interesting. Are the cameras on board or off board?
It's off-board. The robots themselves, they do not have any cameras, nor are they equipped for them. Typically, and this also is the case in industry, you know, when robots, for example, we have one of the robots we have is a SCARA-type robot, and these are typically used for sorting, and they're very high-speed and very, you know, precise robots. So many times there's a camera on top of say, a table, and suppose you're sorting by color or by shape. The camera is then hooked to a computer, and then that basically then tells the robot what to move and where to move it. So it's similar to that in spirit, what we want to do.
And what are the difficulties with doing a visually guided control?
Well, there are many, both in the image processing side as well as in the control side. From the image processing, this is an area that Motoman, by the way, is quite interested in. You know, these robots typically are used in fairly controlled environments in industry. So even though they might be sorting and moving things, the things that they're sorting and moving from one place to another many times are in expected positions. So the image processing algorithms have an easier time figuring out what it is that the robot is manipulating. So Motoman, for instance, is interested in us developing algorithms that will allow the robots to, you know, not to have to worry about whether everything is structured in their environment. So suppose, you know, they have a box that they have to move, and the box is not exactly in the expected orientation. Well, still, perhaps we might be able to figure out that it is a box, and it is the box that the robot needs to move. So three-dimensional manipulation and rendering of images and multiple orientations as well. That's the kind of thing we would like to be able to handle. From the image processing side, from the controls point of view, just being able to use the visual information to then in real time have the robot respond, as opposed to an open-loop control, which is, again, what is typically done. You know, if you can close the loop with the visual information, then it becomes then much much more flexible what you can do with them.
One thing which is not clear to me yet is what the camera is used for. Is it used for looking at the objects which need to be manipulated, or looking at the robot so that it has some feedback concerning its position?
Well, maybe I'll give you an example to show you what I have in mind. The camera would be mounted not necessarily on the robot itself, but it would be pointing, or it would be looking at the object that the robot is interested in. And, you know, where that mount would be would depend on the application. But, for instance, you know how a very typical control experiment that you can find in many labs, and also in my nonlinear controls lab, is the inverted pendulum. So here you have a specialized robot with a single link that has at the end a rotational pendulum that is, you know, it's only free to move along 1 degree of freedom. So with this experiment, you're able to then have this very simple robot balance the pendulum on inverted, similar to, you know, what you would do as a kid with a broom. Let's say you put a broom on your hand on its tip and try to balance it. So this kind of thing, you know, has been done routinely, and it exists routinely in many control labs. So what I would like to do is instead to have the robot do this task. But now, the way we would do it is we would have two cameras looking at this pendulum thing, which would be something like a rod. And the robot would not be, the rod or the pendulum would not be attached to the robot itself, as is usually done. It would be just like having a broom on the robot's hand, just standing there. And if you have the two cameras looking at this pendulum, and then you can basically, like a human would do, you would know where the broom is. And then you will be able to move your hand to sort of manipulate it and not let it fall. So similarly, if we were to use the visual information to tell the robot where the pendulum is, where the broom is, it would then be able to hopefully balance it on its tip. So what I'm trying to do essentially is to give the robots capabilities that are more human-like. So involving the use of the cameras as if they were real eyes of the robots to do something in real time.
I'd really like to have more information concerning the robots themselves. Maybe you can give us an idea of what are their sensors, actuators, and appearance.
Sure enough. Well, we have six robots in the lab. Three of them are what you would consider the more standard kind of robot. The model numbers that Motoman gives them is HP3. So they are 6 degree of freedom robots with a 3 kilogram payload capability. They are the smallest type of robot that Motoman distributes, and that's the reason why we chose them. You know, they make really big robots for welding and so on, but those would be really too large for our lab. So we chose the smallest ones they have. And this gives also the ability to do things really fast. So I will come back to these robots in a second. So we have three of these. Two of them have a large type of controller that Motoman has, and the other one has a compact controller. So these three robots are mainly going to be used for teaching robotics in introductory courses to robotics and so on. Another robot we have is a SCARA type robot. Number is YSH450. So it's again the smallest type of SCARA that Motoman has. A very fast, very precise robot for manipulation and sorting. And then we have two more robots that are probably the more advanced types that we will be using for research. One is called IA20. It's a 7 degree of freedom robot, at Motoman, the folks over there call it the snake because it's just so amazingly flexible, and it can sort of wrap around itself in very interesting ways. So this robot, because of its flexibility, I think will allow us to just do some very very interesting movements. Finally, the last robot we have is the DIA-10, and this is a dual-armed robot, so it has two arms attached to something that looks like a human torso. Very sort of intriguing. Look, each of the arms has a 10-kilogram payload, and in total the robot has 15 degrees of freedom, so it's just a very amazing machine. Motoman markets this robot for assembly, you know, because it looks so much like a human. They sort of envision this robot using the two arms to take hold an object and with the other arm attach something to it. For example, you know, like a human would do. So these two last robots that I mentioned, the DIA-10 and the IA-20, are the ones that we are right now starting with. Research-wise, so we will be outfitting these robots with cameras and trying to figure out what their capabilities are. As far as the sensors that they come with, Motoman doesn't really provide them with anything other than the standard. So inside the robots, you know, they have the servo motors have their own internal sensors for the control system. And they also do not have any end-of-arm tools right now. Another company called SAS Automation, they're donating end-of-arm tools to us, which we will be getting in the next couple of months. So once those arrive, we will have the robots equipped with hands that maybe have pressure sensors and such.
So as you said before, these robots up till now in the industry have been open loop, and with these cameras you should maybe be able to close the loop. Do you have any vision as to what industrial robots could be like in the future maybe?
Ooh, well, that's an intriguing question. Well, you know, industrial robots have been around for a really long time, and people have had all these hopes and visions for them, you know, to become more human-like. And it hasn't really happened so far, at least to that degree. So what I believe will happen is that the integration between the computers and the robots and things like cameras, I think the visual feedback and the visual surveying path, I think, is probably the most promising as far as the industrial robots is concerned. So I believe that this will continue as, you know, image processing becomes more powerful with more powerful computers. It will become possible for, you know, automated algorithms to figure out more about the environment of the robots, thereby allowing them to do more closed-loop behavior. So another example that I would like to give to you, if it's okay, is for an application, is this. With the HP3 robots that we have that I mentioned initially, you know, these are, as I said, relatively simple and standard robots. But if we equip them with the right hardware and the right also software and cameras, one thing that we hope to be able to do with them is to make them juggle. Right now they're mounted on tables and they're about 3 meters apart from each other. So if we were to synchronize, say, two of these robots and have cameras looking at them, it's conceivable that you could have these robots sort of juggle between themselves, so throw a ball between each other and maybe several balls. So, you know, it's a task that perhaps by itself doesn't seem to be very practical, but it really is very challenging from many points of view of research that I think, if solved, would open up lots of very practical things that could be done in industry.
So your industrial robots, besides the research aspect, are also very good at dancing. For example, on the Star Wars music or Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, which just came out recently. Can you tell us about these performances?
Oh, sure. Well, these were... we had a lot of fun doing this. A PhD student here at the university... is working with me on these robots. His name is Tem Messé. He is, you know, to be fair, he's the one who actually did all the hard work. we decided that we wanted to have the robots do a very nice demo for the opening of the lab, the formal opening, which took place in November 21st. So for this opening, we had to develop, you know, a demo that would be catchy and sort of intriguing. And we decided to go for the dance. It seems like something that the robots could do very well. And we, you know, we chose some music that we thought people would recognize very well and would enjoy. So the idea would be that the robots would dance to the beat of the music, which is easier said than done, especially for the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. For that, we chose the interpretation that is found in the movie Fantasia, you know, the original Fantasia movie. And that interpretation of the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies is very, the rhythm is very flexible, let me put it this way. So each beat is pretty much different. So we had to go through each beat, analyze its length, and then synchronize the action of the robot to the length of each beat so that, you know, they would dance and really not look like they are doing something chaotic. So it was a lot of hard work, but I think at the end the result was quite nice.
Yeah, it looks great. And just for the people who are listening, so you had how many robots dancing together?
Well, we had the dual arm robot was acting as a conductor. So, you know, you would see this robot with the two arms sort of directing its attention to the other two robots, which are on the other side of the room. So the dual arm robot would direct the other robots, and these two robots were dancing to the beat.
I've really had fun watching these robots on YouTube, and one thing that I noticed is that the people who watch the movies posted comments such as "so cool," I want to do this when I grow up," etc. Do you think it makes industrial robots maybe more attractive?
That's my hope, really, and I sure think it does. I mean, this kind of presentation of the robots, I believe, makes them look very, very attractive to people. And really, that's one of the many objectives we have with the lab. You know, the applications that I told you about before, you know, like the pendulum and the juggling and so on, you know, by themselves, as I said, they may not seem to be very, very useful, but for one, they're, I think, very cool. So if people see this going on, they might think, wow, well, robotics is sort of, you know, very interesting, so maybe I want to study it. And hopefully this will attract more young people into the field. I think that right now, if you look at the whole field, you know, there are the industrial robots like this one's here. And then there are also the small robots that are mainly found in Japan that are made with servos and that look very humanoid. And so, you know, this small type of robot is similar to Asimo, but smaller and cheaper. Are becoming, you know, quite prevalent, especially in Japan and also here. And you know, the humanoid robots are probably right now the more eye-catching and sexy, I would say. So at the same time, you know, there are the industrial robots that do the real work, and you know, the hope is that perhaps by making them do this sort of dance and funny applications, that they will, you know, they will look to people to be really, really interesting and you know, the amazing machines that they really are.
Can we expect any other performances from your robots in the future?
Ah, absolutely. Yes, we are hoping that, you know, once we have the manipulators, the end-of-arm manipulators come in and so on, we will be able to have the robots do maybe another dance or something else perhaps, but certainly we will keep the videos coming.
We've mainly spoken about the Motoman Robotics Lab so far, but you're also the director of the Nonlinear Control Lab. What type of nonlinear systems have you been working on?
Well, the Nonlinear Controls Lab has a variety of experiments, including this inverted pendulum that I mentioned before. We also have a 3-degree of freedom helicopter in it. It's a helicopter that cannot really fly. It's attached to a table, but it has every other degree of freedom that a real helicopter has. We have a magnetic levitation experiment. We have a group of mobile robots, tabletop mobile robots, that we are using for coordination research. We have some experiments that we have built ourselves, including a rotational, a reaction wheel pendulum, an inverted wedge, and some different things. So mainly what the lab has is a collection of electromechanical experiments that are particularly suitable for advanced controls research and testing.
And what makes them nonlinear?
Well, that's it's a very good question, and I've been thinking about how to answer it best. A good short answer is hard to come by. But maybe the way I would put it is like this: linear systems really do not exist anywhere, and yet every undergraduate engineering student learns to use linear systems and linear tools. So what a linear system really is, you can think of it as a simplification of reality. Nonlinear systems are really more like what reality is really like. So they have lots of complexities and behavior that is just very difficult sometimes to deal with. So, for example, if you think about an aircraft is a very good example of a nonlinear system. You may be able to make it fly straight, but then if you start to increase things like the angle of attack, or if you change the thrust, or you do things that the aircraft is not expected to do in normal operation, then the aircraft might do very crazy things like crash. You know, so a crash is just a very nonlinear behavior. The aircraft was, and then it suddenly is not anymore. So that sort of thing is what makes what a nonlinear system is. Just a very complex system that can do things that are just are difficult to deal with from an engineering point of view.
With respect to all this research you did on nonlinear control, what can you apply to the industrial robots?
Oh, okay. Robots are, again, nonlinear machines. So the actual control task of making the robot move from one position to another, that is in itself a nonlinear control task. So Motoman is interested in having us take a look at some of the control algorithms, and we might do that in the near future. So basically make the way the robots move each of the links to reach one position from another position, that sort of task, you know, a very basic task, but a very important one as well. So we might start with that, and that, again, involves the application of nonlinear control methods. And then every other of the applications that I mentioned, like the juggling and the balancing of the pendulum and just, say, the simple act of catching a ball, all of that involves nonlinear control and nonlinear analysis to some degree. Because of the fact that the robots have very potentially complex behaviors that they could take, and they can move from one position to another along many different paths. So just choosing how to move the robot from one position to another is a complicated issue that makes use of potentially makes use of nonlinear control analysis methods.
Just as a final anecdote, you were speaking of flying robots before, and this summer you were at the Boeing Welliver Fellowship Program. Maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
Oh, sure. Well, that was it was a lot of fun. I feel really lucky and privileged that I was able to attend. The Boeing Welliver Fellowship Program is a program targeted for faculty. So it's an amazing opportunity that Boeing gives. It's about 10 faculty per year that they choose. The way the program works is that people, you know, this group of 10 faculty from all over the country, they go to different sites of Boeing, and then they are given the opportunity to interact and basically take a look at pretty much whatever they want within, you know, the vast wealth of Boeing operations. In my case, because I'm interested in controls, I spent most of my time in the Seattle area, working with the flight controls team of the 787 Dreamliner aircraft. So I spent a lot of time with these folks, and they are, you know, a lot of very, very talented controls engineers over there. And they presented to me some of the problems that they had. I tried to help them a little bit with what I could. And basically what I got from it was a very eye-opening view of Boeing in general about aerospace and just flying machines, you know, which are again another thing that interests me a lot.
Does what you learned on the smaller aircrafts sort of scale to Boeing?
Well, to some degree, yes, because, you know, an aircraft is an aircraft, but of course a big one presents complexities that are just not found on something of a smaller scale. Starting with the fact that, say, commercial airplanes that Boeing makes, which is what I mainly spend my time on, you know, they're supposed to be safe, and they are. Of course, they build them to be really, really safe, and they have an incredible track record of safety. So whatever decision they make from an engineering point of view has to be backed up by a lot of analysis, and a lot of people have to look at this and sort of come to an agreement that, yes, this is the right decision. So suppose, you know, as a control engineer, I would say, you know what, I want to use nonlinear control techniques to do this, which is what I told the Boeing folks. And they told me, well, we would too, but getting that approved and getting that analyzed and getting that, getting everybody to agree on something like that would be very difficult. So therefore, we would rather not. So, you see, it just presents a lot of constraints on what you can do engineering-wise. You see, it just opens the field to a lot of other considerations that one would not have on, say, on a smaller aircraft.
Thanks, Raoul, for being here with us on Robots.
Thank you very much, Sabine.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guest, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Our next show will air in 2 weeks, but in the meantime, stay in touch through our forum for the latest news and hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Pick and Place with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.